We need to talk. It's been a rough ride. From a culture bent on burning itself down to attacks from within. But by the grace of God, we've been given a moment, a chance to make lasting changes. We can rebuild what's been torn down, but we have to build with what will last, the gospel of the kingdom. This April, let's sit down. Let's talk about what matters. And together, we'll build something that lasts. ReformCon 2025. Tickets are limited. Lord willing, we'll see you in Tucson.
Hey everybody, welcome to Ezra Interviews. I'm Dr. Michael Thiessen, and today I have independent researcher and writer Dr. Michael Wagner on the show. So we're excited. Stay tuned. Well, everybody, the heart that I have for young adults really gets expressed when we start planning our Worldview Youth Academies. And we want you to let your children know that in 2025, there are two opportunities for your young adults to get out and join one of our Worldview Youth Academies. So July 11th to 17th, we have our U.S. Youth Academy in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. The price is $8.95 US, and we are excited to be presenting another great line of teaching and experiences for your young adults there. Also, up in Port Colborne, Ontario, July 20th to July 25th, we have our Worldview Youth Academy in Canada. So please, folks, if you haven't signed your young adults up yet, please start doing that. It helps us to know and expect how we can plan. And we really want to run these great programs because we're going to tackle topics like the conversation Michael and I are going to have about Alberta and secession. So welcome to the show, Michael. Thanks for coming on. And I'm so glad to be talking to you about two of your books, both involving a fairly current topic, and that is, what does Alberta do? So I want to frame this conversation in two ways. First, I want to frame it in the most current situation. So President Donald Trump here in the U.S., he's throwing tariffs at Canada. He is talking fairly strangely, I would say. Like at the beginning, it was a really good joke. That seems to continue, where he keeps talking about Canada becoming the 51st state. So that, of course, has Canadians all across the country and Americans wondering what is going to happen in North America. Now, there's another element to this conversation to which you've been writing for many years, and that is most Canadians look at Alberta and say, Alberta would be way better off alone. So in Quebec, you have the Quebecois running referendums in Quebec to talking about leaving Canada. And then if you just look at the wealth of Alberta, the natural resources of Alberta, I've been saying almost for my entire adult life, why is it that Alberta doesn't leave Canada, or at least do it so seriously that the rest of the federal government has to take the province of Alberta seriously? So that's the frame for the conversations. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being on with me.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So you've written two books to this subject. Why don't you tell our listeners about two of your books on this subject, and then we're going to get into No Other Option, because the outline of that book, I think, is so helpful as a conversation.
Sure. Well, actually, if I can add a predecessor book, like No Other Option, I wrote that in 2021 as a result of another book I'd written in 2009. Like as a young man, as a teenager, in fact, I'd been involved in the Alberta independence movement in the early 1980s. And there was no history of that movement written. So to make a long story short, in 2009, I wrote a history of what's called the Alberta Separatist Movement. And there was no response to it at that time. Stephen Harper was prime minister. There was no separatist movement in Alberta. So that book got very little reception until 2019. There was a federal election in 2019 where Justin Trudeau was reelected, and there was a wave of anger in Alberta that led to what was called the Wexit movement. Now, finally, that book that I'd written in 2009 began to get attention, and people started saying, well, you've got to update this book, you know, about the Alberta independence movement. But instead of updating it, I decided I'd write a whole new book, which became No Other Option, which was actually not so much a history of the movement, but a case for Alberta independence. Now, from my perspective, the case for Alberta independence rests a lot on Alberta history and Canadian history, because, you know, there's been a lot of Western discontent, a lot of discontent among prairie residents in Canada since the beginning, like for 100 years or more. And that was represented in various political movements. But none of those political movements advocated for the independence of Western Canada. You know, that we had the Progressive Party in the 1920s that represented farmers, and the Social Credit Movement in the 1930s and onwards in Alberta. These were, you know, movements that were for people who are discontent with the way the West was treated within Canada, but they never advocated for independence. And so although the West was discontent to some degree, Canada basically worked pretty well, you know, when you look at a big country, until Pierre Trudeau came along. Now, Pierre Trudeau changed everything as for Western Canada and for Alberta in particular. He started it. Well, first he brought in his, you know, Official Languages Act, which was to try and make, I mean, the idea of Trudeau getting into politics, largely he wanted to make Quebec feel at home within Canada, which, you know, was a nice sentiment. But by bringing in the Official Languages Act, he made French much more prominent in the Prairie provinces. And a lot of people didn't like that. It was seen as kind of a cultural imperialism. So that was kind of what sparked the origin of the first Alberta separatist groups. But still, it was a very minor, it was a very small sentiment in Alberta until 1973. Because what happened in 1973 was there was a war in the Middle East, which caused oil prices to skyrocket around the world. So now Alberta had had oil for many years, and it was a beneficial resource, but the price of oil had been very low, like around $3 a barrel until 1973. And then within a matter of weeks, it went from $3 a barrel to around $11 a barrel. What Pierre Trudeau did was that for oil sold within Canada, he reduced the price, the Canadian price of oil, it was called. So when Alberta sold its oil within Canada, we'd get much less money for our oil than we would get at the world price. And also, Alberta was already exporting lots of oil to the United States. And Trudeau put on an export tax on Alberta's oil. And this was unprecedented in Canadian history. And our premier, Peter Lougheed, called it the biggest ripoff in Confederation history, because under the Constitution, the provinces own the natural resources. And so as Alberta exported oil to the United States, the federal government was taking a huge chunk of what should have gone to Alberta. So that began, you know, the energy wars, what we call the energy wars in Alberta in the 1970s between Peter Lougheed, our premier, and Pierre Trudeau. So Alberta was not being treated fairly, as we felt, because we were not getting the revenue that we should have for our oil resources. And of course, at that time, with the technology they had, they were afraid that the oil might run out in 10 years or so. And so Peter Lougheed's idea was, we got to get the money while we can so that we can save up, you know, with the Alberta Heritage Fund. So once the oil is gone, we have the money, you know, to keep our economy going. So anyway, to make a long story short, Pierre Trudeau was the one who started the Alberta independence movement and the Western independence movement. He was the one who created the conditions where people would actually think about that seriously, because nobody really took that seriously until Pierre Trudeau was prime minister. And then when he was reelected in 1980, you might remember in 1979, there was a federal election, and Joe Clark won a minority government. He was from Alberta, so it was expected Alberta would finally get a better deal from the federal government. But his government only lasted a few months, and because it was a minority government, it was voted down in Parliament. There was a new election in February 1980. And the Liberal Party at that time was, you know, explicitly campaigning against Alberta, in the sense of, you know, one of the Liberal campaign organizers said that the unstated Liberal campaign slogan for that election was "Screw the West, we'll take the rest," because they were saying to Eastern Canada, "We'll put Alberta in its place if you reelect us." So Pierre Trudeau did win re-election in 1980 on that basis. And within a few months, he brought in what was called the National Energy Program, or NEP, which is still legendary in Alberta, because it was an attack on Alberta's oil industry. It was an attempt by the federal government to take much more control of Alberta's oil industry and the revenue from that. And the effect of that policy was to harm the oil industry. Many people lost their jobs. Many people lost their businesses. It was very harmful to Alberta at that time. And like I say, it's legendary because you can still talk to people today whose families lost their homes or jobs at that time. It's very well remembered what Pierre Trudeau did. And so so that no other option, I go back to this history and I explain from the beginning how the separatist movement got going, why it did, what are the sentiments. And I blame it very much on Pierre Trudeau, because even though Canada never worked perfectly, we had a pretty good federal system for a large country until Pierre Trudeau kind of decided that he didn't really like the way it was working and he wanted to make an increasingly centralized country. And actually, there's lots of aspects to Pierre Trudeau's political agenda that show that. For example, his Charter of Rights and Freedoms was part of his bigger program to make Canada a more centralized country. But in no other option, I'm trying to explain to people the history of how this got going and why Alberta should consider independence. Actually, I think that Alberta independence is the best option for the province, the only realistic one, because we have two options: the status quo and independence. And actually, that ties into my second book, which is Time to Leave: Canada Cannot Be Fixed, because there are many people who think that because of Alberta's problems within Canada, maybe we can get reforms made to the country. Maybe we can change the constitution so that Alberta's voice can be heard in the national government. And Time to Leave explains how we tried that so much. We tried that with the Reform Party, which was very popular in Alberta during the 1990s, and we elected many members of parliament, and also with the Senate Reform Movement that started in the late 1970s and went on through to the time of Prime Minister Stephen Harper. We tried to reform the Senate. Albertans have tried various political initiatives within Canada to fix the country so that our voice could be heard, so we could feel we're being treated fairly. And in every case, those attempts to fix Canada have not been successful. And that is because the political power in Canada resides primarily in central Canada. And I mean, this is how it should be, in the sense that Ontario and Quebec have the majority of the population, so they should have the majority control. Like that makes sense. But we could have reformed our institutions so that smaller provinces like Alberta could have our voice heard and we wouldn't be harmed by federal policies. But we haven't been able to achieve that. And so, having failed to achieve those reforms, it's my view and the view of some others that the only way we could have a prosperous and free province is to become independent of Canada. So that's kind of a bit of a long, lengthy answer. I hope I'm getting at what you're trying to get with the question there.
No, I've been looking forward to this interview for 2 weeks now. Sometimes when we have a conversation about a subject matter that someone like yourself knows so much about, you say things in a summary form so quickly that I like to slow down. And did I hear you correctly? So I actually want to ask you one of those, did I hear you correctly? Because in reading about that, of course, you were talking a lot about the West Wanted In, the chapter in No Other Option, and then Pierre Trudeau and the change that he wrought. Two things you just said there in that summary, though, that I want to re-go over. The federal government tariffed Alberta oil as an export. So, right, did I hear you correctly? So, right now, we are in a world where tariffs are a new conversation to the general population. I think if you look at political history, tariffs are not in any way an abstract or new conversation. That they're fairly normal in international trade. But tariffs is a word for so many Americans. So here, Donald Trump is attempting what would be reciprocal tariffs, that if a country taxes an export from the United States, then, well, if that country is trying to sell something into the United States, it's taxed at the same rate. And the idea, of course, is that then tariffs would eventually be eliminated because there's free, fair trade, not a one-slanted fair trade. Are you saying that the federal government, the Pierre Trudeau government, the Liberal government at that time, actually taxed Albertans from selling their own oil to bring income into Canada. So that it would, like, if they sold their oil outside of Canada, that it was actually the federal Canadian government that was taking their money. Am I understanding you correctly?
Yes, that's essentially, for the most part, like, it wasn't that the federal government got all the money, but they got a large percentage of it that they were not entitled to from an Alberta perspective. So it's different from a tariff because it didn't affect the oil price to the Americans. The Americans were paying the world price. What it affected was Albertans because we didn't get the massive profit from the oil that we should have because the federal government was taking a large percentage of it. And of course, as the oil price would fluctuate, the amount that Alberta would get and the federal government would get would also fluctuate. But the bottom line was that Alberta was not getting the revenue from its resources that it was entitled to. And the federal government was taking a large percentage of that. And then the federal government would use that money to subsidize imports of oil from the Middle East into Eastern Canada to keep the price of gasoline low for people in Eastern Canada. So they're using Alberta's money to subsidize foreign imports of oil into Eastern Canada. And Albertans did not, take kindly to that.
Also, just unpack that, because again, this is so much a part of the current situation. So in the United States, this is what's happening, where you would have, let's say, a Chinese product comes into the United States at a low price, then an American product gets sold into China, and then that product is taxed, and so then the governmental money from the American product coming in goes to subsidize the cheaper product for the Chinese company, what's happening is the Chinese company is growing its market share from US tax dollars. And you're saying the Canadian government was doing a similar thing, where the Saudi oil, for example, would have been increasing their market share in Eastern Canada because they're supplying more oil, but it's actually Albertan profits that are subsidizing a fixed price.
Essentially, that's right. Yes. Like, I'm not sure of which market share, for each country, but the oil that was being imported into Eastern Canada from foreign countries was being subsidized in order to keep the price low for consumers in Eastern Canada. And the money that was subsidizing it was the money taken from Alberta's oil that was exported to the United States. Yeah.
So folks, you can see that, right? Instead of Alberta making lots of money, then producing more oil and supplying it to Canadians, Alberta is selling their oil, their profits are reduced, and Canadians don't see a change in the prices simply because the market share outside of Alberta or within Alberta, we don't know it, to the east, the market share is growing and it's outside oil coming in. So the consumer doesn't know, the consumer doesn't see the price change, but there is a significant penalty, and even just economic growth, economic depression caused for Albertans there. Now, you actually make that point fairly clearly when you say that, the federal government has taken, I think it was was it $500 million or $500,000 from every Albertan family? You cover that in an earlier section of your book.
Yeah, like I think that was actually the foreword by Vince. I think he mentioned about $500,000 per family, but that's over a long period of time. Like, there's I quote in there a professor from the University of Calgary who did the calculation that from 1965 until 2018, Alberta had made a net contribution to Canada of $630 billion. So that's a huge amount of money. That's the net contribution. And I think what Vince did was divide the number of Alberta families by that to arrive at that huge number. Yes, so it is. It's a very large number.
Yeah, so then it's $500 million per family. So help the average person understand that, because typically when you have I would assume, is it private oil companies? Would there be private and public oil companies in Alberta? Or would all of this profit be coming? Because I think the average person doesn't realize how this is costing a family. So can you explain that between the public and private income and revenue, how families would benefit if that money stayed in the province?
Yeah, well, the families would benefit from the increased economic activity. Like the oil companies are private, and there's like oil field servicing companies, you know, that, you know, provide the drilling and the maintenance of those kind of things. So it's not just the oil companies that produce the oil. There's a huge background of other companies that serve the oil companies. And then also too, when there's a thriving oil industry, you have to have, you know, stores to supply the employees. You have, you know, the professionals to, you know, the dentists and the doctors and stuff. So the oil economy, the revenue from that trickles down to a large percentage of the population. So anything that hurts the oil industry and reduces the oil economic activity kind of filters throughout the whole economy and hurts different aspects of the economy. So for example, in the National Energy Program that I mentioned, when the oil industry took a downturn, that hurt families of various different industries, because a lot of the oil companies, they would move their equipment out of Alberta. So the oil servicing would be reduced. And so the people that supply, you know, food or clothing or whatever to those people, their businesses would also be reduced. So essentially, it's kind of like a wave. You know, when you throw a rock into a puddle, you know, you see those waves. And so the oil industry would be the center of that. And you'd have waves of economic activity. And so many Albertans, like much more than just work for the oil industry, their lives, their livelihoods are from the, you know, from the residual economic activity from the oil industry. So that's how people benefit. It's not just, you know, the oil companies getting money, but they have to hire people, and then those people, you know, need to be supplied. So it spreads throughout the economy. So the oil industry is our biggest economic sector, and it helps so many of the other sectors because of the money that it brings in. So it helps, you know, a huge percentage. And also, now that I think of it, because of the tax revenue that the provincial government receives, it also benefits everybody, because that supplies the money for our health care and our education. Like the provincial government gets, you know, tax revenue from oil companies, but it also gets royalties. Like most of Alberta's oil, like it's called the mineral rights are owned by the provincial government. So the provincial government gets a very big royalty on most of the oil. And that is a large percentage of our budget, you know, for paying for the various services. So every Albertan benefits from the royalty money from the oil, because the government is using that money, you know, like I mentioned, for health services or education or various other services. So when the oil industry gets hurt by federal government policies, it hurts every Albertan essentially to one degree or another. I think what Vince calculated, it was about $500,000 per family over a period of time. That's a large amount of money, but, you know, so approximately 500,000. I can't remember that's probably over that several decade time frame. So it's not like a check that people would have received or anything like that. It's just how it would have, you know, flowed into them through their jobs and investments and even, you know, property values and things like that.
Well, and those royalties, you know, there are some oil countries that the state is making so much off of their royalties, they actually do write checks to citizens. Now, again, I don't really love that as a socialist background, but like potentially if there's that much wealth being generated and the royalties making that much profit, certainly the writing of a check might not be totally out of the question if there was really going to bless the individual Burton family. So this really is both just in a, you know, a capitalistic economic sense, and then a relationship of province to citizen sense. This really is a dramatic loss for anybody who's living and working and attempting to pay for their costs in the province. Now, there's one other thing that you bring up outside of economic. You bring up lots of other things, but one thing that really caught my attention when you were talking about this failed history or this history of failed activism to make a change. You also talk about just briefly the desire or the Western push for a triple E Senate. And how the Canadian Senate is actually not as representative as it should be. I thought that was a fascinating point, and I had to go and re-research that reference point because it actually revealed how our Senate is populated right now. Can you talk about the idea of the Triple E Senate and what's the problem with our current Canadian Senate and how that as a, you know, as a representative device fails Albertans as well?
Sure. Well, like the Canadian Senate was set up, more than a century ago. And at that time, the number of senators might have been, you know, correct for representing the regions. Like, I don't know for sure. But for now, the way the population distribution is now, it does not represent Canadians and Albertans in particular very well. Like the way it's supposed to work is the House of Commons is supposed to be representation by population, which we have. And then the Senate is supposed to be like a regional representation, so that we'd have a better way of communicating regional concerns into the Parliament with the House of Commons. But because it was structured so long ago and it has not been reformed, it does not give us that kind of regional representation that we need. And so I was actually in the late 70s when Peter Lougheed put together a committee to study how Alberta could get better represented, that a committee member there who was a law professor recommended that we have an elected Senate. See, that's one of the big problems with the Senate now too. It's appointed by the Prime Minister. And, you know, the current Senate is mostly appointed, I think, by Justin Trudeau at this point, because I think senators are appointed for life. And there was so much turnover in the Senate that Justin Trudeau was able to appoint his own people. So it represents, you know, his views more than anything else, but it doesn't represent regional views. So that this law professor suggested having an elected Senate with equal representation from each province. Now that's two of the three E's. So we talk about a triple E Senate. So the first E would be elected. The second would be equal, like equal number of senators from each province. That's kind of how the American Senate works. There's equal number of senators from each state. And then effective powers. The Senate would have effective powers to block the House of Commons. So if we had a Triple E Senate, then the Western provinces would be properly represented in the Canadian Parliament, and we'd be able to have our concerns heard, and we'd be able to block any legislation that would be very harmful for our interests, like the National Energy Program. So this Triple E Senate idea really took off in the 1980s. And there was a committee for the Triple E Senate, and the Alberta government got behind it. Like we had a progressive conservative government with Don Geddie as our premier. Don Geddie got behind it. His party got behind it. Don Geddie actually created a committee to promote the idea across Canada. And then Don Geddie held Canada's very first Senate election in October of 1989. There was a vacancy in Alberta, and Don Geddie held an election. And the winner was General Stan Waters of the Reform Party. And I'm not sure what the deal was between Don Geddie and Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, but Mulroney didn't want to appoint Stan Waters, but he did. And so we had an elected senator in Canada for the very first time. So at that time, it really looked like the Triple E Senate idea was on a roll. So we had an elected senator. The Alberta government was supporting it. That was also at the time the Reform Party was taking off, and the Triple E Senate idea was very central to the Reform Party. And you mentioned the phrase, the West wants in, and this is an important aspect of the Reform Party, because Preston Manning, who his father had been the premier of Alberta for 25 years, like Alberta's longest serving premier, who was a very strong Christian man, by the way. So Preston Manning formed the Reform Party. Like, he had seen the sentiment in Alberta for Alberta leaving Canada, and Preston Manning wanted to keep Alberta in Canada. And he said, let's take the energy of these people who are so upset, and let's create a federal political party that will get Western voices into Canada rather than out. And actually, that really represented Alberta better and represented Westerners better, because there's not like the people like me who think Alberta should be independent, like, the sentiment for that is actually often among the most patriotic Canadians, if you can believe it. Like the Canadians, the Albertans who want independence are often very deeply patriotic Canadians who feel that they've been betrayed by their country. Like I spoke at a separatist meeting a few years ago where they started out by singing O Canada. You know what I mean? Like these are the most conservative, patriotic people. They just feel they've been betrayed, and they would rather have a reformed Canada. They would. And that's why the Reform Party was such a good idea. This is what people really wanted. Let's fix the country so that our voices can be heard. And then we won't have this, you know, problem of the federal government attacking us. That's what most people actually would really want. And so Preston Manning had the best idea, and they tried for year after year. You know, we elected in Alberta, most of our members of parliament were Reform Party MPs for several years, also many from Saskatchewan and BC. But the way the system works is they were blocked because most of the MPs are from Central Canada, and they were not interested in the reforms that the Reform Party was presenting. And that just shows that our attempts to make the country better from our perspective cannot get anywhere. That's why I think we should become independent. Now, I think I've drifted, I'm afraid, from your original question. it was the Tripoli Senate.
No, that was really helpful.
Idea kind of. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'll just add one more thing with the Tripoli Senate. Mm-hmm. That is, you know, Stephen Harper was one of the original Reform Party MPs. Now, later he would become the leader of what was called the Canadian Alliance, which was the successor party of the Reform Party.
Yeah.
Then the Canadian Alliance would join with the Progressive Conservative Party of Canada to form the modern Conservative Party of Canada. Stephen Harper became prime minister, and he did believe in reform, Senate reform, and he tried. He introduced several bills into the Senate and several bills into the House of Commons to reform the Senate. But, you know, he was thwarted every step of the way. There were premiers who were against it. There were people within his own caucus who were against it. Eventually, Quebec would launch a reference case against one of his bills. And so he had to also launch his own reference case to the Supreme Court of Canada. And the Supreme Court said that any reforms that Stephen Harper would want would require a constitutional amendment. And getting a constitutional amendment in Canada is incredibly difficult. And so that essentially put an end to the Senate reform movement. But my point is that Westerners tried for several years, even decades, to get Senate reform, and it was blocked and it was blocked and it was blocked. But the whole idea was to get our voice heard within the national institutions in Canada so that we wouldn't feel like we had to leave the country. You know what I mean? We tried so hard to get in. You know, like we said, the Preston Manning slogan, the West wants in, the East did not want us in, is kind of what the conclusion we reached at the end.
Yeah, that, again, thank you for that summary. It's so helpful for people to understand. And of course, I think the vast majority of Canadians, vast majority is the wrong word. I think there is a great number of Canadians who feel the exact same way. As you were talking about it, that's how I know I felt during COVID. That's how I know the trucker convoy organizers felt, in the sense that, you know, these are very patriotic people. They want Canada to not become what a small number, I guess I need to stop saying that, because Canadians are voting for Liberals. So maybe that leads us into your next book, It's Time to Leave, which, of course, people know that I chose to do personally. And you're trying to compel an entire province to do that. The one thing I did want to note before we move on, folks, like if you think of the House and then you think of the Senate, the idea is of checks and balances. But can you imagine a Senate that is not elected? Well, of course, most Canadians, I don't think, even think of the magnitude of that problem. So we have something like Bill C-4 foolishly unanimously passed and, you know, getting unanimous consent in the House. And individuals are thinking, oh, okay, great, maybe that bill will be blocked by the Senate. But when you have a Senate that's appointed, let's say conservative or liberal, that Senate is, you know, politically attached to the individual who appointed them. And so this idea of an appointed Senate is a major power problem for representative government in Canada. It's been like that for a long way. And then now that you've had such a victory, like I'm thinking about that in the American context, and I don't even think Americans could get their head around the fact that, like, maybe the only thing that would be comparable might be the appointments to the Supreme Court, where, you know, who you vote in is very important for who they appoint to be on the Supreme Court. But then again, there's only a certain number of seats, a certain number of seats available, and then it's a lifetime appointment. So, you know, when those come up, they don't come up often. So, as you, in your book, you make a transition, and I think it's very helpful in the book. I really appreciated this chapter that we're going to talk about next. Again, this is, again, No Other Option, Self-Determination for Alberta, that Dr. Michael Wagner has written. Michael, you go on and you ask the question that every Canadian is asking. So I literally was at church on Sunday here in Kentucky, where, you know, a group of us Canadians left together. And so we have a mixed church, but lots of Canadians there. And literally someone on Sunday said to me, yeah, I'm going to vote conservative. And I said, yeah, like, that's fun. Why bother? For what reason? I'm going to vote Christian Heritage Party, or I'm going to vote PPC. Both are a protest vote of some sort, because we know that neither are doing well enough to be able to get enough steams. But I want to put my vote where my values are. And, you know, the response to that from my buddy was like, well, we got to have the conservatives have to be able to get somewhere. So we get to this question in your book, the Conservative Party, is it the solution? And of course, I personally, and as a social conservative, feel it is not the solution for any Canadian. In fact, it's not a Conservative Party. They have the benefit of a totally false brand. But and I can even bring up another example of that just currently. I just received an article just the other day about another pro-family, pro-life candidate that Pierre Poilievre's Conservative Party is not allowing to run for a candidate. This is LifeSite News, dated Monday, March 24th. So we're talking just 3 days ago. The Conservative Party has informed a former pro-life and pro-family MP that he will not be the candidate for his riding in the upcoming federal election. On March 23rd, in a Facebook post, Pierre Lemieux, one of the few pro-life and pro-family conservative politicians, revealed that he's been informed he will not be the Conservative Party candidate for his local riding, despite representing the party from that area from 2006 to 2015 under former Prime Minister Stephen Harper. And so, like, even right there, we have another example where I think the Conservative Party is failing all of Canadians. But why don't you share with us your perspective from an Albertan's perspective, from someone who's arguing for the independence of a province? How is the Conservative Party, you know, other than, you know, Kenny becoming our most infamous lockdown, throw pastors in jail premier, how is the United Progressive Conservative Party not the solution for Albertans? Provincially, or I guess the Conservative Party, the PCs federally.
Yeah, well, like from the perspective of the book, I'm much more focused on the federal level with the Conservative Party of Canada, because that's what so many Albertans, when we're in the kind of situation we're in with a Liberal government that's attacking our oil industry, many Albertans just think, well, let's just vote Conservative and that will solve our problem. But they're wrong, because it doesn't solve the ultimate problem. The ultimate problem is the structure of the Canadian government and how every federal government has to cater to the interests of Ontario and Quebec if it wants to be in power. So I look at this historically, like back at the time of Pierre Trudeau, like he actually resigned in 1984 and was replaced by John Turner. Then shortly after that, there was a federal election, and Brian Mulroney, who was leader of Progressive Conservative Party, he won a landslide majority victory. Every Alberta MP was part of the Mulroney government, and we thought our problems were over. We thought our problem was the Liberal Party and Pierre Trudeau, and we thought, well, with Mulroney in, things are going to be okay. But they weren't okay. And the biggest example of what happened was in 1986, like Canada had recently got the CF-18 fighter jets, and those fighter jets needed to be maintained. It was a very expensive government contract. There was only two cities in Canada with facilities that could maintain the CF-18. One of the cities was Winnipeg, and one of the cities was Montreal. So the federal government held a competition to see which of those cities had the best facilities at the best price for maintaining the CF-18 contract. And on the basis of the government competition, Winnipeg won the competition. And so the Mulroney government awarded the contract to Montreal, because they needed to shore up their support in Montreal for the Progressive Conservative government. So that led to a real big uproar in Western Canada. It demonstrated how Western Canada was mistreated by the federal government when the federal government itself goes against its own contract, its own competition, you know, the results of its competition, it goes against that to award Montreal. And it was actually, that was the biggest single event leading to the creation of the Reform Party, because there was like a wave of anger against Western Canada. part of it was because we had helped to vote in Brian Mulroney. He was our guy. And then he betrayed us. He backstabbed us. But this showed very clearly that it wasn't the political party that was the problem. It was the political system that was the problem. Because every federal government to stay in power must have lots of members of parliament from Ontario and Quebec. And so the Brian Mulroney's government, favored Quebec over Winnipeg because they wanted to keep those seats. They needed those seats to stay in power. So that led to the Reform Party. Now, there have been other examples. That's the biggest single example of how the Conservative Party fails us. And I mentioned earlier, Stephen Harper was a very pro-Western prime minister. I mean, he was from Calgary. He had been with the Reform Party. He tried to make changes, and he would have sincerely done it if he could. But he, again, was blocked by the system. There's actually there's a term called the Laurentian Consensus. I've seen that term in academic articles. The Laurentian Consensus is just the basic idea that the federal government has to cater to the interests of Ontario and Quebec. And even though Stephen Harper, as a Reform Party MP, would speak against that idea, as prime minister, he had to cater to the Laurentian Consensus. So there's nothing he really did as prime minister that makes him stand out as doing something for Western Canada, like not because he didn't want to, but because he couldn't. The system prevents him from doing that. So even if Pierre Poilievre really wanted to help Alberta, his hands are tied. And he's already spoken out in favor of the equalization program in the sense of saying he would not make any changes, major changes to the equalization program, which, of course, transfers large amounts of Alberta money to the federal government, which much of it goes to Quebec. He's not going to pull Canada out of the Paris Accord, which is, climate change obligations that are used to justify actions against the Alberta oil industry. And also, there's many people in Alberta who've been campaigning for an Alberta pension plan, because every year we over-contribute to the Canadian pension plan by several billions of dollars. So if Alberta had its own pension plan, we would keep that money here and Albertans would benefit. And Pierre Poilievre has spoken out against an Alberta pension plan. So he might personally have been in favor of these privately, but in order to win as prime minister, he has to speak out against these things that would be beneficial to Alberta. So it's the political system itself is not beneficial. Like, it's the political system leads Conservative Party leaders to make decisions that are not favorable to Alberta. So the even electing Conservative Party MPs as we do, and a lot of the Conservative MPs from Alberta are good guys who want to do good things for Alberta, but their hands are tied by the political system. And so even though they're good people and they would like to do what's right, they can't. And so the Conservative Party of Canada is not the solution to Alberta's problems within Canada. And even the United Conservative Party, our provincial party, has lots of really good people in it. But, Premier Danielle Smith, she's a federalist and she wants to keep Alberta within Canada. And so what she's doing is, trying to flex Alberta's muscles, so to speak, to exercise our sovereign rights under the Constitution to the degree that we have them as a province, as a way of Alberta being able to protect its own interests to keep Alberta in Canada. She actually has the authority, if she wanted to, her government could hold an independence referendum based on Canada's constitutional law, but she probably won't because she's a federalist. Although, the situation could change if we're in an election campaign right now, and if Mark Carney wins a clear majority, there will be uproar in Alberta over that. And there would be pressure on her to take pretty substantial measures, to placate the Albertans who are angry about a Mark Carney government.
I did have an excellent time here at Worldview Academy. I'm just so thankful that God actually brought me here.
I love beach volleyball, and I love the lake, and I love the competitions. I love camp, team stuff. I love that.
The things that they're teaching here are foundational.
We live in such a biblically illiterate time where teenagers don't get the foundation.
I need to have these foundational biblical truths in order to stand on something. If I don't have anything to stand on, I'm going to get washed away by culture and the secularism of the world.
Definitely a lot of good doctrines taught, a lot of strong theology, raising up another generation to know how to defend God's word and love his word.
And I think that we've fallen away from that and the truth of the gospel, and we've got to learn these things. And I'm glad the Ezra Institute Worldview Academy has been doing that.
the Bible is the Word of God. The Bible is the Word of God, and the Bible is the Word of God. I love that.
All of the talks and the speakers and the mentors and the staff are so kind. You learn so much. It feels like you're thrown into the deep end with the amount of amazing information you're given.
Not sugarcoating any of these social issues and giving a very biblical faith-based reason as to why we need to stand against and stand for certain issues.
Ezra has definitely equipped me to go out into the world to talk to everybody about Christ and his goodness.
And it'll help grow your faith and grow your knowledge especially.
I'm so grateful that this academy has been doing that.
Which leads us, so I'm going to ask this question as an outsider, meaning I'm going to ask this question as an Ontarian, because again, I am usually very confused by politicians. So I'm living in the United States, and Donald Trump tropes Justin Trudeau, trolls him and mocks him and plays with him a little bit. And if I feel like if I were Pierre Poilievre or if I were Danielle Smith, my answer to the Canadian population would be, of course, if you elect me, I'm going to get along with that president much better than this prime minister is. This prime minister is failing on the fentanyl issue. This prime minister is failing on the trade issues with the United States. This prime minister is anti-oil, and the Trump administration is pro, you know, drill baby drill. Literally, that's the, you know, what was one of the third slogans of the campaign. And again, I've not watched closely, and so this might be updated, but what I saw initially is this, you know, Danielle Smith giving a pro-federation, pro-confederation response. You're obviously seeing Pierre Poilievre do this. And so now Canadians are looking and going, well, we have one option. One of these pro-Canadian, nothing's going to change options. And so we'll pick the most liberal of them all because they're the most anti-Trump. Right. We know these people over here, they say they're anti-Trump now, but we know that they're kind of like Trump a bit. And then maybe on this issue are anti-Trump. But, you know, these people are super anti-Trump. Now, so as we talk about this, my question as an outsider comes, like, obviously, not obviously, what would need to happen for the system to change in the worldview of like an Ontario MP? Because if the federal government is always pleasing Quebec and Ontario, there's something going on in those provinces that is demanding that. Like, I can think of one reason why an MP from Ontario would not want to promote more money staying in Alberta. And that would be so that we could spend more money in Ontario. So I'm asking this question because I am often confused from conservatives on both social issues, so morality issues, issues of being, you know, pro-family, you know, pro-educational freedom, pro-life, lower taxation, individualistic capitalism. And yet they don't seem to be for any of that on the social issues. And then now when it comes to this economic issue, I can see why the federal MPs outside of Ontario would be like, well, it's simple. We want more money. I can't fathom why Danielle Smith is not already on the we're leaving train. So I guess I'm asking you two questions, Michael. Number one, is this a basic greed problem? And what would you do to counsel people in Ontario to say, hey, you don't need our money? Like, I'm asking that sincerely because Ontario would be affected. They have their own GDP. They have their own income. They're trading with the United States. They're trading with the world. What case would you bring from a Christian worldview perspective to say to MPs in Ontario, the system needs to change? And then what would you say, second question, what would you say to the conservative MPs in Alberta with this prime opportunity that seems to be before them? Like, sure, let's go become a 51st state. Well, let's at least become independent and then figure it out. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, as I mentioned earlier, just to deal with that second question first, is that, like, Albertans, generally speaking, are patriotic Canadians. And so the idea of a 51st state does not get a lot of traction here. Like, there is a small number of people for many years, and I know some of them, who are for 51st state, but it doesn't get a lot of traction. Like, we consider ourselves Albertans and Canadians, you know, first, and it just... Like, for me personally, I don't see the attraction of joining the United States. In fact, I have arguments against it, particularly with regard to, I mean, like, let's say we join the United States now, things might be okay, but we're going to get another president later who could be another Joe Biden or worse. You know what I mean?
Right.
So we could be going from the frying pan into the fire. So that's just kind of a basic thing. But so the 51st state idea does not get a lot of traction here. The independence idea gets more traction, but even still, there's still a stigma attached to it. Like, it's still not the kind of thing that a majority of people have been able to buy into. Like, in that book, actually, No Other Option, I talk about how polling has shown, though, there has been a growth of support gradually over time. Like, before Pierre Trudeau, before the National Energy Program, in fact, in 1980, support for independence in Alberta was in the single digits, like 4%, 5%, 6%. After the National Energy Program, it's always been in the double digits. Sometimes, actually, there was a poll done in December that showed that 37% of Albertans thought Alberta would be better off outside of Canada. That's a very substantial amount of people, even though it's not close to a majority. So that even that idea is still not, hasn't reached majority territory. I think, though, to put this in context, what Albertans are really watching is this federal election. More than the Trudeau, more than the Trump thing and the tariffs and the 51st state idea, Albertans are watching this election. And I've seen a lot of Albertans say, if Mark Carney is elected, I'm going to become a separatist. Like, there's a lot of people who've just rejected that all their lives, but now they've become so frustrated, you know, under nine plus years of Justin Trudeau attacking us. And if after all those years of attacking us, Eastern Canada is going to elect the next guy who's going to have similar policies, that's going to be a trigger for lots of Albertans. So a lot of Albertans are actually just watching that election campaign right now. And that April 28th result is going to have a big impact on Alberta, whether we got, you know, if we get Pierre Poilievre in, even though, like I say, I don't think he's a solution, many Albertans do. And so that will reduce the temperature reduce the support for independence. But if Mark Carney is elected, you are going to see a lot of activity. So actually right now there is a group, sorry, go ahead.
I want to just do a follow-up to that. Just so everybody knows, I've been predicting a Liberal win in the next federal election since the last election, no matter what the polls have said. So I'm very happy that Mark Carney is gaining in the polls. I just want to be able to say that I prophesied about that. Now, I don't know if we go to the whole stoning of the prophet thing, if I got it wrong, but we'll deal with the one. I think that part of the thing that Donald Trump is doing is trying to help North Americans and the whole world just imagine a different world. Like, for years and years, we just have to accept the status quo. Like, and again, particularly around this subject, you know, the American federal government has been trying to acquire Greenland for years. He's trying to help Americans realize, like, that's actually important and we should do it. And then same thing with the Panama Canal, we gave that away for free when we built it, and now China is running it. And so I think this whole thing is a fairly serious desire for people to reimagine their world, even if you don't get the specific negotiated outcomes that the Trump administration is trying for. Do you sense that even though they might be distasteful, it might be distasteful to them, or there might be a bad flavor in their mouth in Alberta for becoming a 51st state, do you think at all that the Trump baiting is at least helping Albertans wake up and go, we could imagine a new Alberta? Or is it just anger against what is considered a bad joke?
Well, actually, I do think that Trump talking about the 51st state idea has caused people to think of it more seriously than before. Like I say, it's still a minority of people that talk about the 51st state and support it, but I think it's bigger now than it was before Trump talked about it.
Yeah.
Like, there's much more discussion about it.
But even if it's not a positive discussion about a 51st state, has it gotten more people talking about independence? Do you sense that?
I think so. Yeah. Yes, I would say so. Because actually, in order for Alberta to become a 51st state, Alberta would first have to become independent. Because my understanding is, and I've heard this from others, that the United States cannot annex a piece of Canada constitutionally, but it can absorb an independent jurisdiction. So for those who support the 51st state idea, they support an independent Alberta because an independent Alberta can consider becoming a 51st state, or even there's people talking about Alberta becoming like a territory of the United States. For those who don't want to become a 51st state, we could become a territory and at least have the economic benefits without some of the political ramifications. And there's a group called the Alberta Prosperity Project. They're a pretty big organization here. And right now they've got a 4-man delegation who are trying to arrange discussions with the Trump administration officials to find out what the Trump administration officially thinks about Alberta independence and Alberta as a 51st state. And so actually they just had a news conference yesterday, those guys. The leader of it is a guy named Jeff Rath. He's a lawyer, and he's supported by Dr. Dennis Modry, who's actually a very famous surgeon here, a former member of parliament, and I can't remember that his name, and then another fellow. Anyway, they are like, these guys are in the public eye, and there's getting public discussions about them. Like, they're not representing the Alberta government, but they're going on a fact-finding mission to see, you know, we assume that the Trump administration is favorable to 51st state for Alberta and independence, but we don't know. Like, there's no official statement on that. So they're going down with the intent of talking to the Trump administration officials, coming back and telling Albertans what these alternatives are. So this is kind of a step in that direction. And it, you know, I think it's very helpful because we need to know those things before we can make good decisions. We can't just assume that Alberta could become a 51st state. We need to have some information about that. And also, we think it's likely that a Trump administration would be more favorable to an independent Alberta than, say, a Biden administration. But we don't know that until we've actually talked with the people there. So this delegation is actually going down there. So there's a sense in which there's movement in the direction that you're talking about, because there are people who are, you know, taking action on those kind of things as an at least exploratory to see what we'd have to do that. And so it has, you're correct then that the Trump's discussions have led to a bigger discussion here in Alberta about 51st state and about Alberta independence itself.
I want to get back to that question I asked you about a worldview advice, Christian worldview advice to any MP outside of Alberta. Why would they give Alberta's wealth back, or why would they allow Alberta to have economic growth? But on this point, the reason why I asked you the question is I am appreciating the reimagination of the world. And what I mean by that is you just felt like a boot lifted off your neck the moment Donald Trump was elected here in the United States. And I'm hoping that even if it's confrontational, even if it's not done in the most respectful way, I appreciate humor. So I have zero problem with the joke. I think it's brilliant. So, but some people might go, oh, it's just not sensitive enough. I am glad that it's pushing the conversation, because I think this has been a problem for Canadians, is that the political will is not there because the social vision, it's unbelievable. If we were to go and look at, and even Michael, you expressed the tension. If you went and looked at all of the, I would say, Christian, God-fearing, capitalistic conservatives who would be trying to affect the system, they always come up against, and especially in Alberta, you're experiencing this, the lack of imagination of what Canada could be. It just must be what it is. And of course, you have a socialistic French influence that wants us to believe that and accept that. And I just love how just with a little tweet here and there, and then now, you know, prolonged press releases where he's just talking about it. I'm very glad that the conversation is being pushed. And I certainly, if you're a conservative or you're someone in Alberta, you've got to be thinking independence. Even if it's step one to step two, I think what Michael just said is great. You need more information, but I applaud this delegation. It's what Pierre Poilievre should have done the very first time Trump said it. Poilievre should have gone a plane and gone down there and said, "What do you mean by this?" and played off of it. But he won't, because the Canadian political will, the socialistic, the secular will, is just, we are making a ton of money from the way that the system is now. So let's get back to this question. How would you persuade MPs? Or is the answer, you can't, we're done, we tried? But even from a worldview perspective, how would you try to persuade an MP outside of Alberta to say, hey, look, you are robbing Alberta of its profits?
Yeah, well, from a Christian worldview perspective, I would focus on the aspect of how government needs to be limited and it needs to be closer to the people. So in this sense, Canada's original federal system was better than it is now, because the federal system, you know, you have the national government to deal with, things like military, foreign affairs, and banking, where the provinces would deal with, you know, education, healthcare, resources, resource management, and things like that. And that's the way we were more before Pierre Trudeau. And I think it's a more biblical system, because you want the decisions to be at the local level as much as possible. You know, the family makes the decisions that are best for the family, the city makes the best decisions for the city, and the province makes the best decisions for the province. You don't want to transfer that authority up to the top, you know, to the national level of government, when they're so far away from the local situation. And I think that Canada was better off before Pierre Trudeau, when we had that more decentralized federal system. And I think it just reflects the biblical worldview more when it's the local people making the decisions that concern their lives, you know, that aren't part of the national discussion. So it's a decentralization of power. I think the decentralization of power is more consistent with the Christian worldview. And I think in the past, Canada was more like that. And I think if we could go back to that, in a sense, it would be better. The national government concern itself with, you know, military, foreign affairs, things like that, and leave the provinces to deal with their natural resources. And, you know, what this ties in with the whole climate change agenda, because, Justin Trudeau brought in his carbon tax, and that was challenged by the Alberta government at the Supreme Court level. And the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Justin Trudeau's carbon tax, but in doing so, they thought that, I can't remember the exact wording, but they knew they were overriding some of the provincial jurisdiction in doing that, in giving Trudeau the power to bring in the carbon tax, because they said the climate change emergency is so serious, we have to be willing to override some of these provincial jurisdictions. You know what I mean? And so that was an example of transferring federal provincial jurisdiction to the federal government, and that's kind of the direction that Canada had been going. And that's the problem, that, you know, I think that even MPs outside of Alberta could be potentially persuaded that we need to let the provinces have their own jurisdictions, as they did in the past, more so than they do now. And I just want to throw something in here in terms of the wealth transfer. Like, I don't think Albertans are in principle against sharing the wealth with other Canadians. I don't think that's been the problem. Like, even the 70s, when we were getting much lower than we should have for the oil price, the problem wasn't so much that they didn't want to share. It was the way it was being done and the amount that was being done. Like, the Pierre Trudeau was ignoring us. Like, Peter Lougheed was willing to sell our oil at a lower price than the world price, but not to the drastic degree that Pierre Trudeau was doing. And so I don't want to leave the idea that Albertans don't want to share and don't want to participate in Canada, you know, and help other Canadians. It's the way it's being done, a top-down, you know, heavy-handed manner against us, and where we're not even given a voice in what we have to do. So Albertans, I think, like I say, would be comfortable with a certain degree of equalization and other things, but the way it's been done for several decades, it's like slapping us. You know, they take our money and then they slap us around and tell us we're greedy bigots. You know what I mean? That's how we feel. That's how it seems.
Well, that's the irony of the situation. You can't help see that in your book. On every paragraph is Alberta makes a lot of money, Ottawa takes it, and then Alberta Alberta shouldn't leave because if they left, they'd be greedy, terrible people. Like it literally is that situation. You're stealing our money, and then you're telling us that we're greedy. By the way, just to your principle on that, I do like to bring things back to scripture, folks. Exodus 18, when it comes down to a judicial system, that whole idea, that very small advice that Jethro gives to Moses, where Moses says, look, the people stand before me all day and night because every dispute is brought to Moses. Again, that's an example of a far off government that is bottlenecked by distance and size, and you're not achieving true justice. And Jethro's advice is you've got to break this down locally and then only bring to yourself the hardest cases. Which of course is exactly how we get our municipal and provincial and federal Supreme Court system and an appeal system is by that advice. And so, yes, of course, certainly returning more authority to local authorities is better than the nationalism / socialist, not national socialism that we're seeing across Canada. And then of course, to the last point, you know, whether or not you're profiting and enjoying that profit, I think the concept of robbery, unfair taxation is a form of robbery. And so I think that we need to go back into even stronger language of is this taxation actually just a form of robbery against Albertans? Okay, so just, you know, we're kind of coming to the end. When I say coming to the end, we typically go for an hour, but I think, Michael, we're going to go for 20 more minutes. Are you okay?
Yes.
Okay. Let's move then to the legal conversations, because I think there, you know, there's a difference between something being legal and lawful. So obviously there's that conversation, but you get into your book the fact that there is a legal course, a legal pathway to secession for Alberta. And so I somehow converge the conversation of the federal government so easily throwing aside the Constitution, as we've seen so many times in recent 5 years, and then of course the specific examples you've given in Alberta, just that you gave, and then talk about the legal pathway that Alberta might have. And I'm really hoping that this podcast is helpful for individuals who are thinking about how to vote and behave in the upcoming election. So why don't you talk about those two things?
Sure. Like the Canada has a constitutional pathway for any particular province to become independent. And this is very important because there are countries where the constitutional law forbids any jurisdiction from leaving, but Canada's does not forbid that. And the reason is, at least in terms of the constitutional law, like in 1995, Quebec held its second independence referendum and that almost passed. And because of that, in order to get clarification of Canada's constitutional law on a province leaving, the federal government launched what was called a reference case. And that's where a level of government refers a case to, or refers a question to the Supreme Court, asking the Supreme Court its opinion on Canada's constitutional law, you know, on a particular question. So the question was, can Quebec unilaterally declare independence from Canada? Because, you know, that's kind of what Quebec was looking at doing. The Supreme Court ruled and said, no, Quebec cannot unilaterally declare independence from Canada. However, if Quebec held a referendum on independence with a clear question, and a clear majority of people voted in favor of it, then the federal government has an obligation to negotiate with Quebec over its independence. So that's essentially, you know, in a nutshell, what that decision was about. So that was in 1998 that the decision came out. Then in the year 2000, the parliament passed a law called the Clarity Act, which was to flesh out some of the details, you know, of that secession reference case. So we have the constitutional law is in the secession reference case of 1998, and the legislation is in the Clarity Act of 2000, but they coincide in that they're both providing a legal and constitutional pathway for a province to secede. So the any province in Canada can hold an independence referendum, and as long as it has a clear question, and as long as there's a clear majority, then the federal government is obligated to negotiate that province's independence. Now, the Clarity Act gives the House of Commons the authority to declare if it's a clear question or not, and it also gives the House of Commons gives them the authority to determine what a clear majority would be, because a clear majority would most likely be more than just 50% plus one. And I think that's wise, because, you know, when you're doing regular legislation, say a tax rate or where a bridge should be, 50% plus one is fine in a democracy. But when you're creating a brand new country, you know, 50% plus one probably isn't good enough, because if someone changes their mind the next day, you don't even have the majority that you need. So, you know, a clear majority, you know, in like in the United States, a supermajority is say 2/3 in the Senate or something like that. So in different parts of the world, there's different precedents as to what a clear majority or a super majority would be. So, but that would be, that's a wise thing to have. Also, the clear question is wise, because if you look at the questions that Quebec asked in the 1980 referendum and in the 1995 referendum, they're kind of convoluted. Like, they were understood, generally speaking, in the media and so on, as independence questions. But if you read them, it's not guaranteed that a citizen would come to that conclusion. So it's important that the question be very clear, so that the people know what they're voting on. So, when, you know, if they're voting for the independence of their jurisdiction, it's important that they understand that that's what they're doing and they're not doing something other than that. So those two points are very good. So that is Canada's constitutional law and its legislation, that any province can do that. And so, you know, for me as a Christian, I feel very comfortable recommending that people can follow a constitutional pathway. If it was illegal, there might be a different question. But because they are, it's legal and constitutional, there is no obstacle for a Christian recommending that a movement in a province or you know, can take steps towards exercising their legal and constitutional rights within Canada. There's no problem there. So I hope I answered that question as to the pathway.
Yeah, no, that's very helpful. Like in the United States, it's 60%. To get a supermajority because of the filibuster rule in the Senate. And so, like, you know, it's the difference between 10 seats. And so, as you're explaining that, Michael, I'm thinking, man, the words like clear question, clear majority, and the fact that of the House of Parliament get to decide if that was all true. It reeks of okay, so never do anything you want to do, even though it's obvious. Why would they pretend that your decision was a clear question and a supermajority? But certainly, it changes the trajectory for you. It changes the trajectory as Christians to be able to dialogue and discuss this. You're not talking about treason. You're not talking about any real illegal behavior. You're talking about taking a democratic process through that is under the laws of Canada. So I'm glad about that. I learned that as I was reading the book, because even in the past 5 years, there's all of this question about civil disobedience and what's the line there. We're not even talking about that here. You can be well within your Canadian legal, the Canadian legal framework to have these discussions. So what would be next if you were to advise Albertan separatists? What would be your steps? Obviously, you've mentioned the importance of April 28th and the outcome of the elections. Again, if Mark Carney wins that, then you've said there's going to be a particular response. What would be your advice to the movement now? And it does seem in your latter book, when you say no other option, and now you're saying it's time to leave, that you really are promoting it's time to get serious about leaving. So what would be your advice?
Well, see, the problem is that the independence movement has gone in waves. Like Preston Manning talked about this, how Western protest movements, they go in waves. There'll be some incident that happens and there's a wave of support for something and then the wave fades away. So this is why the election on April 28th is so important, is because if Mark Carney gets elected, there will be a wave of support for independence, and we have to capitalize on that wave in order to, you know, convince the government that we need an independence referendum. So there'd be two lines of advice. If Mark Carney wins, we're going to get a wave, and we're going to be able to ride that wave, probably, possibly at least, towards an independence referendum. If Pierre Poilievre wins, the air will be taken out of our movement to a large degree, and we're going to have to plan for the long haul, because we have to wait for Pierre Poilievre to make some kind of slip up that would, you know, offend Albertans, or wait until he's, you know, he loses a subsequent election. So so much rides, I'm afraid, on this election, April 28th, because of the wave nature of support for this in Alberta and in Western Canada. So the election is a very key event in terms of this discussion. And if it goes one way, our movement will get very strong and we'll have a likelihood of success. And if it goes the other way, the air will be taken out of our tires, and it's going to be a long time before we get another opportunity. And also, I guess, in the background of this is the Trump administration, as we've been talking about. It's very likely that the Trump administration would be more favorable to what we're doing than a subsequent administration. And so it's kind of like the window is open right now. And so if the next president is a Democrat, he'll be much less likely to support what we're doing. So with this election and with Trump being the president, this is kind of looks like the window of opportunity that we need. And the window might close depending on the outcome of the election. I'll be in it for the long haul, but we'll certainly lose a lot of support if Pierre Poilievre becomes prime minister.
Well, thank you so much for your time. What an insightful bunch of works you've written. Thank you so much for your clear mind and your clear prose. I've really enjoyed learning and reading. Everybody, again, Michael, what are the two most recent books you want people to go out and share people where they can find your work? Which website?
The best website is called merchantship.ca. It's actually a local Alberta homeschool distribution organization. Like they're friends of mine. It's a family business. So they sell all kinds of homeschooling information and resources. And they also sell my books. So their shop is called Merchantship, and their website is just merchantship.ca. And you can find my books there.
By the way, I just can't help but give a shout out to homeschoolers and homeschooling families. Friends, if you're wondering what type of weird people they are, Michael is one of them. And so just think of the depth of information that his kids are learning as he takes responsibility to educate his own children. So they're going to come out with some pretty clear abilities. Michael, thanks so much for being on the show. Everybody, thank you for listening. Please share this podcast across all of the platforms. We really want to further the discussion. Canada does not have to turn into a woke, socialistic, Marxist country where individual justice is not satisfied. There can be a different vision for that nation. Maybe not. Maybe just for Alberta. So thanks for listening. Godspeed.